Hey friends, welcome back to another episode of Christ in Me with Addie, where we seek to live out a John 3:30 life. John 3:30 says, "He must become greater and greater and I less and less." Let's be real. In today's world, it can seem impossible to live out what the Bible calls us to do. Not only can it be hard to understand sometimes, but finding the time to read the Bible, to understand the Bible, to know the Bible, it can just be overwhelming. So I created this podcast so we could walk alongside each other, share some of our stories and struggles, but also to where the Lord is bringing us, so that we can encourage one another and stay rooted in His Word. It's my prayer that you walk away from each episode saying, "I know that that is Christ in me. I know Christ in me." So let's get into today's topic. Hey guys, welcome back to Christ in Me with Addie, where today we're not just joined by myself, but we are here with Mike Jones. Say hey, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm so excited to have him on because he just lends awesome insight. I kind of say your videos are a little snarky, a little silly, where you dish it out, but you also know how to receive being dished at, I guess. So today I'm really excited to hear what you'll bring to the table. Mike, why don't you just take a second to kind of introduce yourself and let everybody listening know who you are and a little bit about your ministry?
Yeah, my name is Mike Jones. I have a master's in philosophy from the University of Arizona. And so I do a lot of apologetics online. My main channel is on YouTube called Inspiring Philosophy. And I also do a lot of response videos on TikTok, Instagram. And I just try to build videos that would answer various apologetic questions. And so a lot of my videos, the long form videos, are just giving evidence for the Christian worldview. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I first found apologetics through Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, which if anyone hasn't read that book, it's a really great book, but it gives you sort of like the meat and potatoes when it comes to Christian questions and then big answers in history. So how would you kind of define apologetics for someone who has no idea what it is, but is curious?
Yeah, apologetics is just providing answers. It's basically what it means. And everyone is really an apologist for their own worldview. If you start questioning an atheist on their worldview, they're going to start to defend it and give answers to objections you're going to raise. A lot of them just don't want to own the label, but everyone is an apologist for their worldview to some degree. And so I would just say, I believe in the Christian worldview. I say Christ is King. So therefore I'm going to defend the Christian worldview and I give answers for it, evidence for this worldview, and I answer objections.
Yeah. And I think apologetics, you know, you're very brave for taking that on. I think it definitely takes a certain personality type because I'm the type of person who doesn't really like confrontation. And I know a lot of your videos, you know, you're just talking with people online or you're having like these online interviews. I've seen you have like open discussion forums with different people and different views. So what would you say to the person who is interested in apologetics, but is maybe nervous about the debate side of it? Because it can get a little heated and people can be very opinionated.
Yeah, well, if you're worried about that, I mean, start slow, just have conversations online and just be nice. A lot of people out there, if you're just nice, they'll be nice back. And if you're, there's a troll, just block them. I mean, honestly, they're not worth your time. They're not there to have a conversation. They're there to try to make themselves feel superior. So if people start insulting me, I just block them. I'm not even interested at this point. Like, I don't have time for you. So start slow. Just be nice and respectful and be willing to be humble. Say, okay, well, I've not thought of that. I'll go research thing. And people will have more respect for you if you have that approach than something else.
For sure. And I think the term is keyboard warriors, right? Those are people who just sit there and they're, you know, clacking all day, typing out their long-winded comments. But I'm with you. I don't think that we can truly engage people in Christ always through like Instagram DMs or YouTube comments. It just kind of starts a war. So having that awareness. But with that, I also wanted to say, as Christians, we will face these apologetics questions. Like, we will be challenged by people with big questions. Well, how do you know your God is real? Like, how do you know the Bible isn't just a book of fairy tales? So if you've ever, those who are listening, if you've ever been hit with those hard questions, we're going to touch on some of those when it comes to Easter, since it's topical and it's coming up. But before we dive in, I want to hear, how did you get started in this, Mike? And how did your social media kind of become what it is now? Like I said, a little snarky, a little silly, but also very, very helpful.
I mean, I just started making videos. Well, let me, how do I put this? So basically, many years ago, many moons ago when the earth was young, it was like 2011, I just saw there was not a lot of good Christian videos on YouTube. There was just snarky atheist videos, there were conspiracy videos, and a lot of Christian conspiracy videos. And I was like, there's got to be something better. I wish someone would do something about it.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I have some time. I could make a few videos and contribute and then move on to my career. And people started asking me to do more videos. Okay, I'll do some more. And then it just started to snowball. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get started on this, just start making videos. Start making a blog. You're not going to become famous, and that should not be your goal. You should, your goal should be, if I can just help a little bit, that's good enough. Because that was the goal I had to start with. And that's what the goal a lot of people who eventually got much bigger, that was their goal as well. So if you have a calling for this, just do it and start small and be willing to stay there. Yeah. You know, that should be our mentality in all of this.
For sure. I share all the time too. Like, I started this podcast because I was not Christian my whole life and I didn't know that there were answers out there. And I wasn't really willing to look for them either. So I started this podcast to help people realize, like, there are answers to your questions out there. Like, we can come alongside each other, but also you don't need a following or a platform to speak about Christ and to put out, you know, the knowledge that you have out there. So I just want to say thank you for sharing the knowledge that you have and encouraging so many.
Yeah. And I would say, remember, Jeremiah didn't really save a lot of people in his lifetime, like two or so. Yet his book has profoundly shaped culture for centuries to come and is very important for the biblical scriptures. So even if you think you're not doing a lot now, you don't know how that could echo through the ages, especially with the way the internet is now and the way everything is online. You could be helping people in 20, 30 years. You just don't know.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, even thinking about that too, like Job probably didn't feel super great in his moment, but think of how many Christians reflect on that when they're suffering. So I just want to repeat what he just said. Like, you don't know how God might be using you. So don't limit yourself. Don't put God in a box. So Mike, I want to hear, where do you source? You reference so many academic sources. Like when people say Easter's pagan or things like that in your videos, you always drop like different academic findings, historical findings. Where do you source these things? And what would you say to the person who's like Googling information, just trying to figure it all out?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it sort of just comes with the territory. You get better at it as you go along. Mm-hmm. One thing I tell people is read the books in my videos. I put so many quotes in my videos. Sometimes I feel like I put too many quotes in my videos to give you the message, but I want to put them in there so you see there are more sources out there for you to look at. So do that. Sometimes when I'm reading books, like they'll reference other books and I'm like, hey, I should read that book too.
Yep.
Things like that. I'll use Google Scholar. I'll use academia.edu. I'll check other apologetic channels. Like sometimes Cameron Bertuzzi will be interviewing someone and I'll be like, hey, I should read that guy's book. Mm-hmm. Or I'll see something like I was listening to Matt Frad's podcast and he was interviewing John Bergsma, who's an Old Testament scholar. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned his book. He mentioned a book by Michael Patrick Barber, a book by Jonathan Bernier. So I just got them all. So there's no one way to do it. Mm-hmm. You just got to start looking into the topic, research things. There's nothing wrong with using Google, you know, research certain things, find blogs on it and see what they reference. Always check the references on videos, blogs. If they don't have any, red flags should be going up. Mm-hmm. But if they do, read those books. Make sure they're from accredited scholars or philosophers. Mm-hmm. Don't be reading some sort of just wacky theories on the pyramid from some nobody. Like, they should have a degree behind their name is sort of a thing I do. And that's one of the reasons I've also not really written a book yet, because I only have a master's in philosophy and I'd like to get more. So it's like, you know, I would just check the references, check the sources, that kind of stuff, and you'll do fine.
Yeah. And with that, I want to say too, like, there's so many sources out there and it's really easy to go down the Google like rabbit trail hole of like a million things. And you'll land on things that are not historically sound. They're not even biblically sound. And so what I love about your videos is, you know, when people post these things, they're like, did you know that Easter is actually pagan? You know, that's where you jump in. You're like, okay, well, let's talk about this. And then you throw up your sources. So I would say start with a teacher or a mentor or someone who has those titles behind their name, but also like the experience under their belt that you can trust. So I watch a lot of your videos. I like Red Pen Logic, I think is his name. Mm-hmm. He's another one. Sun, Mike Winger, like these are all sources that I go to first when I have a big question about the Bible. And so that's what apologetics is. Big questions about the Bible, but there are answers out there and trusted sources if you're willing to look for them. So with all that, let's jump into whether or not Easter is pagan. Believe it or not, this was a highly requested topic, and it surprised me that you guys want to jump in on this, but I think it's because people see these like shock value, shock factor videos, like, did you know that your Jesus is actually the Easter Bunny? Or like these wild things. And then Christians are like, wait, what am I supposed to, is this witchcraft? And then you just want to make sure that you're like following the right path. So let's talk about it so we can clear up some of the confusion. Mike, I'm going to pass it over to you. I know you've answered this question a million times, but is Easter pagan?
It's fine. I'm used to it and I love doing it because it's just easy to address.
Yeah.
Short answer, no, Easter is not pagan. Easter is the celebration of Jesus rising from the dead.
Amen.
Okay. That is the historical origin. We know Christians were celebrating this back into like the second century and probably even the first century. This is just where it comes from. What people get mixed up on is they hear the word Easter and they go, that doesn't sound Christian. That sounds pagan. Mm-hmm. The problem is you're speaking English. Most people around the world call this holiday Pascha or a derivation of that. Why? Because Jesus died during Passover week and rose during Passover week. Mm-hmm. So Christians started calling the Easter celebration Pascha. And that's what it was called in the Roman world, among the Greeks, the Romans. Then when Christians started moving into Germanic regions, they started calling the Pascha after the month it fell in, which is Aostramanath. That was the month it fell in. That month was probably named after a goddess named Aostra. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make Easter or Pascha pagan, just like it doesn't make the 4th of July a holiday about Julius Caesar just because it falls in the month of July. So no, Easter is not pagan. It is entirely Christian in origin. When Christians started moving into Germanic regions, they just started calling it after the month it fell in, which was inadvertently named after a goddess. So you could say the word Easter indirectly comes from paganism, but so do all the days of the week. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, they're all named after gods. Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind when you're doing that. What we know about this goddess Aostra is that she was worshipped in the Germanic regions. The only note we have on her is from St. Bede, who says the month was named after her and ancient pagans had feasts for her in her honor in the season. That's it. Doesn't mention bunnies, doesn't mention eggs, none of that. And in fact, eggs and bunnies were not even associated with Easter that far back. The earliest reference to Easter eggs is like in 1290 in England, when the king requested about 400 or 450 eggs to be decorated for the Easter celebration. That's the earliest reference as far as I can find, at least in English and published English sources. Some suggest there may be older Persian ones, but I've not seen them. Mm-hmm. Most scholars think Easter eggs came from Lent. So Catholics, Lutherans, Anglicans, Orthodox keep Lent. Fast for 40 days. By giving up something, and then you celebrate Easter. In the Middle Ages, you would fast from all animal products during Lent. Mm-hmm. So you basically were a vegan for 40 days. So eggs could keep well, though. So towards the end of Lent, they would start hard-boiling the eggs so they could have a bunch of animal products for the Easter celebration because of protein. That's how Easter eggs became associated with Easter. How did the bunny become associated? Well, not to like the late 1600s, as far as I can tell. Like the earliest reference seems to be the late 1600s. I've suggested in earlier videos, there was an earlier reference in 1572. It now seems like that may not actually source correctly. Like Francis Weiser brought that up, and he didn't actually source that correctly. So some people have pointed out the actual earliest reference to an Easter bunny is 1682. Mm-hmm. So. And how did that become associated with Easter? Well, people would see animals in the spring. So we actually see references to Easter butterflies, Easter foxes, Easter hares, and Easter bunnies. And the Easter bunny just sort of took off since then. Because animals come out in the spring, people are celebrating Easter. Look, that's the Easter animal. Mm-hmm. So all of this is just Christian in origin, mixed in with some European folk traditions.
Yeah.
None of this goes back to paganism. None of this goes back to Ishtar in Babylon or Aostra. So none of this is pagan.
Have you heard of the goddess? I think Ystor is how you say her name. I think she's the goddess of fertility. That's the one I've heard the most, that when you are like referencing eggs or bunnies, you are in essence worshiping this goddess of fertility. Have you heard that?
Yeah, that's another way to pronounce Aostra.
Okay.
So yeah, we know she was a goddess of the dawn. It doesn't mm-hmm. say goddess of fertility necessarily. Okay. I have to check the St. Bede reference on that. Mm-hmm. As far as we can tell, no, we don't know much about her or how she was worshipped. It's just one of those things is like, well, I guess we're just kind of in the dark on her because so little was known about her. So I got the St. Bede reference here, and here's what he says in The Reckoning of Time. He says that Aostromenath has a name which is now translated Paschal Month, and which was once called after a goddess of theirs named Aostra, and whose honors feasts were celebrated in that month. Now they designate that Paschal season by her name, calling the joys of the new rite by the time-honored name of the old observance. That's it. That's literally all we know about her. It doesn't say goddess of fertility. It doesn't mention bunnies, eggs, none of that. So people are just making assumptions based on very limited data.
Yeah.
You know, it's a spring goddess. Maybe it's a fertility goddess. They're trying to do those kind of connections.
Yeah. And see, even what I just said, that knowledge was from videos that I've literally seen people saying, if you're a Christian, you should not celebrate Easter. And here's why, you know, and it's like, well, that brings me to my next question is even if there are, we're just going to say, even if I'm not saying that there are, but even if there are some sort of pagan roots or pagan similarities between what the pagans did and what Christians did now, do you think it's wrong to Christianize ancient holidays?
No. There is no biblical reason for thinking that that is going to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And for one reason, you can look at, for example, the book of Esther. Out of that, we get Purim. Purim is based on Haman casting lots in their mm-hmm. Persian traditions to try to figure out what was the best day to attack the Jews. And they turn that into a holiday. So that actually does have a pagan origin, if you think about it. So no, there's nothing wrong with taking something a pagan did in using it for God's glory, as long as it's not sinful. So if you go to Deuteronomy 12, which the Hebrew roots love to bring up, they take it out of context. God is saying he hates every detestable thing a pagan does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, like child sacrifice. He doesn't hate the fact that they breathe air or they build temples or they have priests, because Israel was commanded to build a temple and have priests. So obviously those are okay things.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing wrong with taking something a pagan may have used to honor a pagan deity and just reclaiming it for God. And a perfect example is at the Vatican. There's an obelisk there, and everyone freaks out. It's all part of the Illuminati conspiracy. They don't do the history. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church didn't move that obelisk there. Caligula did, the pagan Roman emperor. Now, hundreds of years later, when the Catholic Church is in charge, they're not going to act like barbarians. They're not ISIS. They're not going to destroy an ancient artifact. So they just rededicated it as a symbol of a finger pointing up to heaven to Christ.
Yeah.
That's a civilized thing to do. You got this ancient artifact you can't destroy. Mm-hmm. Just rededicate it for Christ. Nothing wrong with that. So, yeah.
And like, is that not what we all are as well? Like, I don't know your testimony per se, or if you've been a Christian your whole life, but I can say I was not. And so in a sense, that's basically what I did with my life and my heart and my soul is maybe I was once involved in what people would quote, you know, pagan things, you know, drunkenness, debauchery, whatever you want to call it. And now I'm a Christian. I've rededicated my life to Christ. And so if you're listening and you've kind of been fear-mongered into thinking that anything that you're doing is pagan when you're just trying to have a joy-filled, maybe candy-filled day with your family, you can't accidentally be pagan. You're either for God or you're for something else. And you really will know where your heart is based on whether or not you follow God, because we get convictions by the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You can't accidentally be a pagan. I got a book over here. I probably could find it if I looked, but it's by an actual pagan called Jordan Paper.
Mm-hmm.
He's an ex-Jew. Now he's a pagan. And he says in his book, you cannot work with these gods, demons, unless you call on them and you bring them into your life, okay?
Yeah.
You're not going to accidentally do that. If you're willfully doing it, yes, that will open you up.
Mm-hmm.
But just decorating an egg doesn't make you worshiping a pagan god just because maybe 2,000 years in Mesopotamia, a pagan painted an egg. Like, that doesn't follow logically in any way.
Yeah. I think there, I don't know your thoughts on this, but there are some things that the act can be a welcoming, for example, like a Ouija board. That's something I would stay away from. But
that's a good point. Yeah. And, but also you're asking the demons to give you, you're opening yourself up.
There. Right. Right. But in my opinion, and it sounds like in yours, painting an egg is not nearly the same as a Ouija board.
Right.
I don't know if there's egg demons out there, but I have not come across one. I'll let you know if I do. Okay. So next question for you, what's your understanding of Romans 14, 5 through 6 as it pertains to like holidays and whether or not it's okay to celebrate holidays?
Yeah, let me just read it here, just so we've got context. As one person esteems one day as better than another, while another esteems all days alike, each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. The one who observes the day observes it in honor of the Lord. The one who eats, eats in honor of the Lord, since he gives thanks to God. While the other one abstains, abstains in honor of the Lord, and gives thanks to God. And I think this is pretty clear if you look at scholars like Craig Keener and what they say on this. Paul is talking generally. He's got specific ideas in mind, but there's general principles we can take from this. Just because somebody may keep the Sabbath, that doesn't mean we all have to. He's keeping the Sabbath because he feels personally called, but he cannot force that on everyone because that's not part of the gospel.
Right.
Okay. The gospel says we are to partake of the Lord's Supper. We are to be baptized. We are to follow Christ by the Great Commission. That's for all Christians, but not the Sabbath, not maybe worshiping on Sunday. Maybe some Christians want to worship on Saturday night. Fine. I don't think God is going to be upset by that. This is pretty clearly a good principle we can draw from this about holidays. If some Christian feels convicted not to celebrate Christmas or Easter, neither you or I should condemn them or ridicule them or try to guilt them into doing that. And likewise, if someone in the Hebrew Roots movement or someone in the Torah observant movement says, well, because I don't keep these holidays, neither should you, because you'll be super extra holy like me.
Yeah,
that's also wrong according to the principles we're getting from Paul here. So I think it's very clear that we should not be passing judgment on one another, that the way to follow Christ is to do exactly everything that I do and live exactly as I do, because the kingdom welcomes all shapes and sizes, all different people. And I think that's one of the beauties of Christianity.
Definitely. And what he just explained basically is that certain individuals will be convicted on certain things by the Holy Spirit, while others will not. So I can just share one of mine really quick to give greater context. But prior to being Christian, I was heavily in the fitness world. And so I was convicted into modesty. But that doesn't mean that my version of modesty is going to be the same as every other person in the world. Do I believe that there is a certain way to dress so that you don't feel weird at church? Absolutely. But I'm not going to look at you and be like, hey, you shouldn't be wearing that because I wouldn't wear that. And so that's where if you feel convicted not to celebrate a certain holiday, don't turn around and call your brother or sister in Christ pagan if they choose to, or think of them as any less of a Christian. And so with that, I want to discuss, you kind of answered this, but do you think that there's anything wrong with celebrating man-made holidays? Because, for example, I think a lot of people don't understand, like, we know that Jesus probably wasn't born on December 25th. Like, we have pretty good evidence to back that up. But it's a chosen day, so we can honor the birth of our Savior. Similarly with Easter, we know that it falls on like a certain Sunday every year, but we don't actually believe that that is the day that Jesus rose from the dead. And I think a lot of people think that Christians are dumb and that we really think it happened on that day when that is not factual. So do you think there's anything wrong with kind of like picking a day, making a man-made day and calling it a holy day or a holiday?
No, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, obviously we have holidays like Thanksgiving, 4th of July, Memorial Day. Is anyone going to get bent out of shape for having an American holiday? Like, that would be ridiculous. And Easter falls on, it's easy to actually know when Easter will be. Easter falls on the first Sunday after the first full moon after the spring equinox. So that when the first day of spring happens, look for the full moon. You see a full moon, you know the next Sunday will be Easter. That's how it's calculated. And that goes back to the Council of Nicaea, when they wanted a standardized way to calculate the date of Easter for the whole Christian world. Back then, they didn't have advanced calendrical systems. Hey, here's a good way to do it. And then this sort of, there's still a little bit of debate until you get to St. Bede, and then that sort of settles everything out. So that's why they picked that day. For Christmas, In the early church, they believed that a prophet would die on the same day that he was born. But for Jesus, it was conception. It was his conception. So Jesus would die on the same day he was conceived. And they thought it was March 25th. They were probably wrong. So they just count forward 9 months. You got December 25th. So yeah, they picked those days just to have days to commemorate two of the most important events in history. There's nothing wrong with having a day to honor these types of things. So, you know, keep sort of give an analogy. A lot of people in parts of the world, like the Middle East or Southeast Asia, that are really divorced from technology, don't know their birthdays. I had a friend when I was in the Air Force, and his name was Tim, and he was dating a girl from Southeast Asia, and she had moved to the U.S. like within like 5 years or something, and she did not know how old she was. She knew she was like 28 or 29, and I was like, "What do you mean you don't know how old you are?" She's like, "Well, that it was my culture. We didn't calculate that stuff." So Mary and Joseph probably didn't know the date of Jesus' birthday because they didn't have watches. They didn't have calendars. They knew he was probably born, you know, like a month or so after this holiday or before that holiday kind of thing. So because of that, there's nothing wrong with picking a day to honor an important event because they probably didn't know the date. And I don't think we have any evidence that God would be offended by that. So there's nothing wrong with man-made holidays or picking a holiday to honor something important that God has done.
Right. And I think it's that anytime people hear like that we've picked a date to celebrate a certain thing, people are like, pagan. But it's like, you know, these actually were probably picked by the companies that are selling you the candy and the cards that have made it such a big deal. Because, for example, you just said the thing about birthdays. Look at how big of a deal we've made birthdays in America, whereas you just said that's not really a thing in other countries. So I don't think it's pagan as much as it is. It's just become like commercialism. And, you know, I'm cool with celebrating birthdays. But if you guys have more questions on that topic specifically, I do have a video on whether or not Christians should celebrate Christmas, which pretty much just restates everything he just said anyway. But let's move on to the subject of Easter and sort of the evidence for Easter and how we know that Jesus really rose from the dead. So, Mike, let's hear your best case and how you know in your heart, but also through your research, that Jesus really did rise from the dead.
Well, we should probably start with the background here. So go put yourself back in first century Judea. Okay, you're a Jew living under Roman rule. You're expecting the Messiah to come. And the Jewish belief at the time would there would be a conquering son of David. He will come, he will defeat Rome, he will establish a new dynasty in the line of David. And then the Jews will rule the world. Israel will be on top. They will be the new Rome, per se. So you're expecting that. All of a sudden, some guy shows up, says he's the Messiah. He's healing. There's claims you hear that he's healing. He's doing things. They kill him. That should be the end of that movement. When Simon Bar Giora was killed by the Romans, that was the end of his movement. When Simon Bar Kochba was killed, that was the end of his movement. When Theudas was killed, that was the end of his movement. When the Egyptian prophet was killed, that was the end of his movement. If the Messiah died, you got yourself a new Messiah. That's just what happened. That's not what we see happening with the Christians. Only the Christians said that only of Jesus, that he rose from the dead and that proved he was the Messiah. So Jesus is killed, and all of a sudden, all of his followers are saying, he is risen from the dead, that proves he's the Messiah, and now salvation and forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to the Gentiles and Jews. That is completely unlike what we would expect coming out of the Jewish culture. So we need to explain it. Scholars have to come up with an explanation for how Christianity got started. How is this movement going to happen in a purely naturalistic way? When you start looking at the evidence, it doesn't add up. So you have basically the early Christians are proclaiming this in Jerusalem, where the Sanhedrin would have the means and the motive to debunk this. They just got to bring out the body of Jesus. They couldn't. So that's incredibly strange. You know, fakers go elsewhere. Joseph Smith led his people out into Missouri, and then eventually they went to Utah. Get away from New York, where, you know, it'd be very easy to debunk this whole stuff just by digging up these cities. He kept moving, that kind of stuff. The early Christians were also willing to be persecuted. Now, we don't know what happened to every apostle, but we do know from the letters of Paul and from the book of Acts that the Christians were being persecuted. So they were willing to be persecuted for this, even though they knew it was true or not. We know they said things that would have been unlikely for them to have made up, like saying that the women discovered the tomb. even Christian opponents like Celsus use that against them. They said, well, you can't believe this crap. You just have the testimony of some frantic woman. Mm-hmm. Like that was an argument they used against the Christians in that day because they didn't trust testimony from women as much as it would be from a man. And I actually think that's why the women are left out of the creed in 1 Corinthians 15, when it says Jesus appeared to his disciples, James and Peter, and 500. Let's just get the facts out, but when they get to the Gospels and they want to tell the story, the women are so central, they can't leave it out. Mm-hmm. It's very unlikely they would have made that up. So when you start to see all these facts, they're very hard to explain with a naturalistic explanation. So you have to explain why Paul converted and why James, his brother, converted. You got to come up with these very convoluted explanations. If you see, you know, books like Gerd Ludemann's or others as well, they become very ad hoc. And what they do, that means is they start multiplying assumptions beyond necessary. Mm-hmm. So maybe these things were invented later, even though there's a lot of good evidence for gospel reliability. Maybe Paul had some sort of internal vision and he had I believe Gerd Ludemann says he maybe had a friend that was a Gentile as a kid that really was bothering him throughout his life. And that led to his eventual conversion and wanting to convert the Gentiles. And you start multiplying assumptions beyond necessity. Whereas the resurrection hypothesis explains all the facts. Mm-hmm. The reason why they preach the resurrection is because Jesus actually did. The reason why they came up with this strange belief is because they witnessed it happening, even though it was completely divorced from the Jewish background.
Yeah.
Now, the response to that is, well, that's a miracle. That is the least probable. Well, that's a bias at the end of the day. We should not start with the position that naturalism is most likely true and therefore miracles have to be judged with a higher standard. We should start from agnosticism and go look at the different worldviews, Christianity, mm-hmm. atheism, naturalism, Islam, you name it, include them all. Which is going to be the most likely explanation of the available data?
Mm-hmm.
When you look at it, Christianity is the most plausible, and it is the least ad hoc. It's going to posit the least amount of assumptions. Now, you may not like those assumptions because they're not natural assumptions, but it does posit the least. We cannot judge based on quality. We can judge based on quantity here. We have the least amount of assumptions when it comes to the Christian worldview. If that's the case, it is by far the most parsimonious explanation. And as Mike Lacona points out in his book, The Resurrection of Jesus, it's got the most explanatory scope. Explain all the facts, the most explanatory power. It can explain them all completely. It has the least amount of assumptions, so it's the least ad hoc. It's plausible because it can explain other areas as well. And it provides illumination on a whole lot of other things. With that, it's just going to be the simplest explanation at the end of the day. So in a nutshell, Christianity is very easy to disprove because it's not just some guy getting visions in his head. Jesus publicly died. He was publicly buried. And then he publicly rose, leaving an empty tomb that was publicly known.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just visions in some guy's head. This is all public stuff that could have been easily debunked, and they couldn't. So when you start looking at the data, the evidence for the resurrection really starts to shine through, and it's very hard to explain all that in a naturalistic way.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, we just can say the best explanation is that Jesus rose from the dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amen to that. My question to you now is, how do we know that Jesus was really dead when they put him in the tomb? How do we know that he didn't just like pull a Houdini and this was some elaborate like escape plan and that he was like a magician or something?
Yeah, I love those questions because there's not a scholar alive that really takes that view. I think maybe one in the past 100 years has put forward this idea called the swoon theory, that Jesus just swooned on the cross and fell asleep. And even the most atheist scholars aren't convinced by that because mm-hmm. the Romans knew how to kill people. Mm-hmm. They weren't going to let some guy just get off the cross. They would have been in huge trouble. They were very good at their jobs of killing people. And so we see Jesus go through this horrible idea. He's beaten by the Sanhedrin guards. Then he's handed over to the Romans and they scourge him and they beat him again. Mm-hmm. Then he's got to carry his cross. And medical experts say that at this point, Jesus was in the early stages of shock. He couldn't carry his cross to the execution site, which was expected of crucified victims. He was suffering shock mm-hmm. from all the blood loss. He gets on the cross. He dies from shock and blood loss. Then they shove a spear through his side, and they would have been aiming for his heart. He's dead at that point. And you can mm-hmm. see a debate I did in February on the channel Modern Day Debate with an Ahmadi Muslim that was arguing for the swoon theory. You mm-hmm. just see There's no good reason to think Jesus survived this ordeal, which is why the almost unanimous attestation of the scholarly community is that he died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you explained it really well, but the Romans would be killed if they didn't kill and do their job. Like, they would be severely reprimanded. And the other thing too, that I think people like disassociate, this was later in history, but these are the same Romans that had the Roman Colosseum that pinned like people against people, like horrific, horrendous death. So they knew how to kill people. And I love in the Bible, I forget whose gospel it is, but they say that Jesus poured out blood and then water. And people have argued that that just can't be, and that's not. And, you know, people who are fighting for that, there's medical mm-hmm. accuracy within the Bible, have said, you know, that that can't be true. Water doesn't come out of people like that. Have you heard that? And could you explain it better? Or I could keep explaining if you haven't.
This is actually a really good way to show John is being reliable here.
Yeah.
So let me pull up the verse here, because it's actually, John says something very interesting when he says this. So he says water and blood came out of his side.
Mm-hmm.
So the soldiers came, they broke the legs of the first, and then they came, they shoved the spear in his side. And he says, but one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and at once there came out blood and water. Then John breaks the narrative and says, he who saw it has borne witness, his testimony is true. Okay, John recognizes that this just doesn't seem like it's going to be a natural thing that would happen. And he's got to be like, no, I was there. Trust me, I saw this. And even mm-hmm. we see the early church father Origen had to explain this away as a miracle, because he's like, this doesn't naturally happen. The heart stopped pumping blood, so there should not be blood pouring out of it. Well, modern medical experts have weighed in on this and said, no, this is probably what would naturally happen from someone who was severely beaten and lost a lot of blood. Pleural fluid would have accumulated in his lung, causing traumatic wet lung. Mm-hmm. And due to shock, it would cause the body to lose its ability to clot blood. So if you stab someone who's been severely beaten and lost a lot of blood, blood will pour out of them because the blood is not clotting anymore. It's not congealing.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, it matches modern medical research. They shove a spear through his side, the pleural fluid comes out, which looks like water. Blood comes out because it can't clot anymore. It doesn't say it was like gushing out. It just says it came out of him. So
Right. Actually,
John's testimony is something it's unlikely he would have made up. Mm-hmm. Because they knew in that world this was not something that would normally happen with a dead body, unless it was severely, unless, you know, in some cases, like with Jesus, where he was severely beaten. So it's something he probably would not have made up, which is why we see later church fathers having to explain it away as a miracle. But it actually, today, it matches modern medical research. So this is actually a point in favor of John's reliability.
Yeah. And I love In Case for Christ, again, by Lee Strobel, they address this as well. And they talk about how that clear fluid that kind of comes out, they would often list things in that time period by quantity. So he listed blood first and then the water, which would be that clear fluid. Different medical people have tried to combat this and say like, oh, well, there would have been clear fluid first under that much trauma. And, you know, even how he listed things shows the accuracy of there's probably a lot more blood coming out of him than that mm-hmm. clear watery fluid, which you said the medical term for, and I don't know the medical term for, but thank you. I love how even scripture, even the gospel points to medical accuracy, points to scientific accuracy. And so often people say, you know, the Bible is just a book of fairy tales and it doesn't go along with logic and science, and faith can't possibly be matched with evidences. And what would you say to those people who are wrestling with that? Maybe they're a little cynical, maybe they're a little bit of a realist. How did you find answers that not only suit your interests, but also, you know, you found accuracy in them? How did you dive into that?
I mean, just start reading what a lot of the experts say. There's a lot of good evidence for the reliability of the Gospels. I mean, it's a good book here by Craig Blomberg, Reliability mm-hmm. of John's Gospel. You got Luke Vandeweghe's book, Living Footnotes on the Gospel of Luke. Mm-hmm. His other book, The Historical Tell. And then you got this book by Michael Patrick Barber that covers Matthew a lot, The Historical Jesus in the Temple. There's a lot of good evidence for the reliability of these Gospels. And so just to dismiss them as folklore without looking at the actual evidence, it's just not being fair with the data.
Yeah.
You just can't, again, start with a naturalistic worldview and then judge all the evidence for Christianity through those naturalistic lenses. You got to be open to the idea that maybe the naturalistic worldview is wrong and there really is something mm-hmm. more to life than just the natural. So try to open up and say, well, maybe the world isn't the way I thought it was. Maybe there actually is evidence for miracles.
Yeah.
You know, like Luke Vandewey gives a lot of good evidence for the Gospels, Mark and Luke, being able to get names right to the point that you couldn't make it up, because even fiction writers couldn't get the naming pattern they get. Only someone who is an eyewitness could get the naming patterns they get when you compare it to historical data. So that's evidence that they weren't making this kind of stuff up, because they have these little like historical tells, as he puts it, mm-hmm. in their works that show authenticity and not forgery. So just start looking at the evidence and try to be open to it, and just don't say, well, miracles don't happen or miracles probably don't happen, so I got to judge this with a higher standard. Try to be open.
Yeah. And with that too, there is like actual data evidence that we have. And I think a lot of times people are like, well, I'm not that into history and I don't really want to study, but like, you can literally just look at numbers. You probably know the exact data, but do you know the comparison of New Testament manuscripts, ancient manuscripts, to like Plato's writings of the time when the Bible was compiled?
Oh, it's ginormous. We have we've over 10,000 New Testament manuscripts. Mm-hmm. And I believe for like Plato, we only have a handful or so. So, I mean, like in terms of just manuscript evidence, we have a lot of evidence for New Testament reliability in the manuscript tradition. And a good book on that is a really short book called Jesus Dethroned by Daryl Bach and Dan Wallace. And Dan Wallace is an expert on New Testament manuscripts. And he just shows, looking at the manuscripts, we can see that there's no evidence any essential Christian doctrines have been changed by scribes. Mm-hmm. Because the moment the New Testament books were written, Christians wanted everyone to read them, so they sent them out everywhere. There was no way one person could control them all and make a change. So if you get a scribe in France making a change, you got manuscripts in Alexandria or in Antioch that aren't going to have that change. And so we can pinpoint when like scribal errors come in, and we can see that they're very reliable.
Yeah. And with that, I talk about this in my episode, How Do I Know I Can Trust the Bible? But there's over like 66,000 cross references in the Bible. And correct me if any of the data I'm sharing, you know, differently, but that's like where something was in Old Testament and then fulfilled in the New Testament, or referenced back Old to New Testament. And that's like outstanding compared to other ancient literature that's available from that time period. And I've heard a lot of people say, you know, well, isn't Christianity just something made for control? And isn't the Bible just something that, you know, people use to take advantage of people? And what would you say to that comment, Mike?
I would say they have not done their research.
Yeah.
There was a great paper by a scholar named Roland Salem, who looked at Christianity and Islam and compared them with different data points. And he found out that Islam was not significant with any of these. But Christianity was positively associated with more voice and accountability in government, more citizen empowerment, more political stability, more non-governmental organizations, you know, people organizing for their rights, as well as the ability to create political transformation. So if Christianity was created to control people, whoever did a horrible job, because it leads to freedom and democracy all over the world. And other studies like, you know, Robert Woodbury's work has also shown this. So it's like, what are you talking about? Do some research.
Yeah. And I mean, if I lived my whole life focusing on love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, all those, you know, fruits of the spirit, I would say that that is a life very well lived, in my opinion. So one final question for you, and this is one that's just like swirling in my brain based on something that you said. So sorry to put you on the spot, but I'm just curious, because we talked a little bit about Joseph Smith for a moment there. You said that, you know, Jesus's ministry did not die out after he was gone, but that I instantly thought in my mind, what about Joseph Smith? Actually, that's a really good question. So what's your take on that? Why do you think that the LDS church has carried on, even though we know Joseph Smith was not a Messiah and not a prophet? Definitely not Jesus. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's something to the psychology of being in a group that really sort of helps to strengthen that. And the Mormons were persecuted early in their history, and that's going to create a strong in-group social connection. I think that was a mistake on Christians' part to persecute the Mormons. Obviously, they should not be persecuted. But that's going to create psychologically a strong in-group connection. We do see some early Mormons actually turning away, though. So you do have evidence of that. But one of the reasons I would say that this is going to spread out is, one, there's going to be a lot of psychological appeal for some of the men, for example, they can have multiple wives early on. Mm-hmm. You're being taken to a new Zion somewhere out there. You know, it's kind of cool to be a part of this new, exciting idea that's going to, you know, supposedly you found this New Testament in the Americas that Jesus apparently wrote. And that seems exciting. Mm-hmm. Now, you could say, couldn't you apply this to early Christianity? Yes, you could, but no one's making a case for Christianity on just the psychological appeal of mm-hmm. the early Christians. We have a lot of other evidence on top of that. When it comes to Mormonism, I just don't see the same evidence. We have no evidence that the Book of Mormon is right, that mm-hmm. there were horses and iron weapons in the New World before Europeans arrived. We have no evidence to confirm Joseph Smith really did translate the Book of Abraham as he claimed. We have found that scroll because Emma Smith's letter with it was found in the museum. I believe it was the Smithsonian. It says, this is Joseph Smith's Egyptian scroll. He translated the Book of Abraham with this. Modern Egyptologists looked at it. They have looked at it. It's not a Book of Abraham. So mm-hmm. Joseph Smith lied. And if that's the case, it's probably also the case that he just lied about his other stuff
yeah.
to get fame, fortune, a following, and multiple wives. That just mm-hmm. seems far more likely when you look at the data. Jesus didn't get multiple wives. You know, he died. We knew his whole career. He was going to die and suffer.
Yeah.
It's very different when you start looking at the data. So you can find some surface levels comparisons to Mormons and Christians. But when you start going into the data more, things don't add up with Mormonism. But yeah. historical reliability of Jesus, the Gospels, really does add up.
Yeah. And just a quick one, as we approach Easter, one that's on my mind is the Palm Sunday prophecy, Messianic prophecy, Zechariah 9:9, where it basically foretold 500 years prior to it actually happening that Jesus would ride into Jerusalem on a donkey and that they would kind of welcome him as the Messiah. And so that's the other thing to look at too, is just the amount of Messianic prophecies and that Jesus was always who he said he would be before he even was. And so when you look at that compared to other people who have kind of stepped into the world and claimed these titles, they just don't even compare in comparison to Jesus.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I know we covered a lot today, guys, and that was a lot. And I know you may have bigger questions from this episode, like, how do I know Christianity is the right faith? You know, there's, you know, we dropped a bunch of other ones. There's Mormonism, there's Buddhists, there's pagans, there's all kinds of faiths. If you're struggling to understand or know why Christianity is reliable, why Jesus is trustworthy, I want to send you over to Mike's page because he answers a lot of these questions. As of recent, I feel like I've seen a lot of combatants videos with Islam, but it's helped answer questions to me that I didn't even know I had yet. So do you want to share kind of your ministry, your accounts, and where people can go to find you?
Yeah, you can follow me on YouTube. That's where I do most of my stuff. So youtube.com/inspiringphilosophy. I'm also on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Mm-hmm. Those are the main sites I use, so you can just follow me there.
Cool. Well, I want to say thanks so much, Mike, for your insight, but also for the work that you do, because it's helped me a lot in my faith journey. And I hope it's blessed all of our listeners today. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a privilege.
Thanks for tuning in, guys, to Christ in Me with Addie, and we will see you next time.